Hello, this is Chris with the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, January 13th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page, Quest for Magic. Horseback riders at Leroy Stable use clinic to help find their stride. From Leroy. Mary Ellen Sherwood said riding her horse Parker is mostly like a walk in the park. All of the time he's perfect. Best horse, all you could ask for, said Sherwood of Mansfield. There are also times, Sherwood said, when the racehorse comes out in him. When Parker rears or spits, Sherwood says she tells him, let it out, man. Sherwood was one of about eight people who registered for a Sunday equestrian clinic at J.R. Equestrian in rural Leroy. The stable's owner and trainer, Jessica Roach of Leroy, said they bring an outside instructor for the clinic, which has a quicker format than a typical riding lesson. Roach, 33, said clinic instructors who have prior experience with the rider also know the horse's tendencies. Many times, she said, the instructor will ask the rider what they want to work on. Roach said the majority of participants at the Sunday clinic were planning on jumping, which is fun. Roach, who also teaches horseback riding and trains horses, said her riders range in age from 6 to 70. She said most clients have one horse, and her stable handles pretty much everything to care for them. But clients are involved as much as people. She said there are several barns in the McLean County area that provide opportunities for horseback riding, but it also depends on what the horse rider is looking for. My clientele is more people where competing is more along their lines. Roach said she also boards and sells horses, while adding she's the best stall cleaner. She said she started leasing barns into 2018 and later got an opportunity to build a 15-stall barn. Now she works with about a dozen riders. Her favorite ride is a 16-year-old mixed-breed horse named Soko. At a show, Soko was formally announced as Southern Comfort. I got him as a 3-year-old from a horse rescue in the area, and he has become like our barn superstar. I competed all over the United States with him and now have kids who ride and show with him. He holds a special place in my heart. If a horseback rider has a bad day, Roach said they just need to go into the barn and everything in your life just disappears. Roach said riders come to love horseback riding because horses are like their free little therapists. She said they can tell horses all of their secrets and bad days, and they're never going to judge us or hate us for it. Sherwood said going to an equestrian clinic means she will leave with stuff to work on. She said it's rewarding to see a change in her horse, too. She said she likes to enjoy a tactful ride of getting her stride just so. Sherwood said she worked on making it correct and straight instead of going for the biggest jump possible. Riding Soko on lease was Sophie Austin. The 17-year-old Monticello girl said she rode Western style for a long time and has experience riding English, too. Her father, Roy Austin, was there to watch the clinic. He said his daughter has been riding ever since she could sit up straight. Sophie Austin said she likes riding because it helps her not get stressed. She said she trusts Soko, and he mostly does what she wants him to do. Sometimes he gets a little attitude. The clinic's instructor, Gilly McPhee, said she worked with Austin on equitation, which is the rider's position on the horse. I'm a big believer in form equals function, she said. If you're not in the right position on the back of a horse, it's really hard to get the right things to happen. McPhee said she will also focus on developing the relationship between a rider and their horse so that they're on the same page. I want you to think it's magic, that you can barely tell that they're doing anything, and that horse goes and canters or trots or jumps the jump. She said it is magic because horses are so sensitive. They will feel a fly land on them in the middle of a snowstorm. The next clinic is scheduled for February 9th. To stay updated on JR Equestrian's offerings, follow the business on social media. For questions, call Roach at 309-212-9390. Also on the front page, ex-speaker's testimony, unusual move. Madigan corruption trial enters its 12th week. In the world of Springfield politics, longtime House Speaker Michael Madigan developed a reputation that people at the State House could count on his word. The secretive Southwest Side Democrat didn't necessarily give it freely. He wanted to know every angle of an issue before saying he would embrace an idea or go all in. And he sometimes took his time before he would sign on to a budget deal or agree to back a bill. But governors, lawmakers, and lobbyists time and again came to a consensus during Madigan's 5 decades in the Illinois House, including a national record 36 years as Speaker. Whether you agreed with him or not, his word was good. Now, 4 years after resigning his seat in the legislature amid a burgeoning federal corruption investigation, Madigan is banking on his word once again. But this time, it's not fellow lawmakers or ward healers he's dealing with. It's a jury of 12 average citizens, and the stakes couldn't be higher. In a move that shocked Illinois political circles, as well as most court watchers and experts, Madigan took the witness stand last week in his own corruption trial, telling the jury repeatedly and emphatically, under oath, he is innocent of allegations that he betrayed his public office and traded official action for legal work and lucrative contracts for his associates. Testifying on your own behalf in a high-profile case is a rare move that is fraught with risk, and one Madigan, a lawyer and legendary tactician, surely considered from every angle. The decision appeared to catch even prosecutors by surprise, though by the time Madigan faces cross-examination, they will undoubtedly be loaded for bear. As Madigan's direct testimony unfolded over 5 hours Tuesday and Wednesday, some of his motives for taking the stand became clear. Contrary to how he comes across on some of the wiretapped recordings the jury heard, the 82-year-old Madigan was relaxed and even charming at times, offering jurors a compelling backstory of a blue-collar Irish Catholic kid who rose to the pinnacle of Illinois power politics through work ethic and moxie. While prosecutors have portrayed Madigan as a ruthless and all-powerful boss, he was able to sell himself as a non-confrontational consensus builder, more interested in building coalitions than scorched-earth politics. It was a lesson Madigan told the jury he'd learned early on from a key mentor, legendary Democratic State Representative Zeke Gorgi of Rockford. The most important thing I learned from him was it's really important to strive to know and understand other people. It's one thing to have your own ideas, but in life, particularly in a legislative body, it's important that you understand everybody comes with their own ideas. Everybody should be given due respect. But even in his direct testimony, the tightrope Madigan was walking became obvious. Trying to explain his own words and some of the secret recordings at the center of the case, while attempting to pawn off many of the more damaging episodes on his co-defendant, Michael McLean, a longtime friend and political consultant. At the same time, Madigan was fully exposed himself to the scrutiny of seasoned prosecutors, as well as opened the door to other previously barred evidence, including a potentially damaging wiretapped call where the Speaker and McLean allegedly laughed about some of their political associates making out like bandits. The trial wrapped up for the week Wednesday afternoon after cross-examination by McLean's attorney. Madigan will likely be back on the stand for cross-examination by prosecutors at some point today, though the timing is uncertain because U.S. District Judge John Robert Blakey plans to hold arguments first on what specific topics prosecutors can cover. Madigan and McLean, 77, of downstate Quincy, are charged in a 23-count indictment alleging that Madigan's vaulted state and political operations were run like a criminal enterprise to amass and increase his power and enrich himself and his associates. In addition to alleging bribery schemes involving ComEd and AT&T Illinois, the indictment accuses Madigan of pressuring developers to hire the Speaker's law firm and trying to win business by secretly supporting legislation to transfer state-owned land in Chinatown to the city so developers could build a high-rise. Both Madigan and McLean have denied wrongdoing. The trial, which began with jury selection October 8th, is heading into its 12th week of testimony. The judge has told the jury he hopes they will begin their deliberations on the week of January 27th, though Madigan's surprise testimony could push that back even further. And from Los Angeles, when to return as crews fight for control. 16 dead, 16 missing, red flag warning set through Wednesday. Firefighters scrambled Sunday to make further progress against wildfires that have destroyed thousands of homes and killed 16 people in the Los Angeles area, as forecasters again warned of dangerous weather with the return of strong winds this week. At least 16 people were missing, and authorities said that number was expected to rise. The National Weather Service issued red flag warnings for severe fire conditions through Wednesday, with sustained winds of 50 miles per hour and gusts in the mountains reaching 70 miles per hour. The most dangerous day will be Tuesday, said Weather Service meteorologist Rich Thompson. You're going to have really strong, gusty Santa Ana winds, a very dry atmosphere, and still very dry brush. So we still have some very critical fire weather conditions out there, Thompson said at a community meeting Saturday night. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Marone said 70 additional water trucks arrived to help crews fend off flames spread by renewed gusts. We are prepared for the upcoming wind event. Fierce Santa Anas have been largely blamed for turning the wildfires sparked last week into infernos that leveled entire neighborhoods around the city where there has been no significant rainfall in more than 8 months. 12 people were missing within the Eaton fire zone, and 4 were missing from the Palisades fire, Los Angeles County Sheriff Robert Luna said. Luna added that dozens more reports have come in Sunday morning, and investigators are reconciling whether some of the missing might be among the dead. There are no children among those reported missing. Meanwhile, the death toll rose to 16 over the weekend. 5 of the deaths were attributed to the Palisades fire, and 11 resulted from the Eaton fire, the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office said in a statement Saturday evening. The previous number of confirmed fatalities before Saturday was 11, but officials said they expected that figure to increase as teams with cadaver dogs conduct systemic grid searches in leveled neighborhoods. Authorities have established a center where people can report the missing. Officials were building an online database to allow evacuated residents to see if their homes were damaged or destroyed. In the meantime, Fire Chief Kirsten Crowley urged people to stay away from scorched neighborhoods. There are still active fires that are burning within the Palisades area, making it extremely dangerous for the public, Crowley said at a Sunday briefing. There's no power, there's no water, there's broken gas lines, and we have unstable structures. The first responders are working as quickly as possible to ensure that it is safe for you to return into your communities. Officials warned the ash can contain lead, arsenic, asbestos, and other harmful materials. About 150,000 people in Los Angeles County remained under evacuation orders, with more than 700 residents taking refuge in 9 shelters. By Sunday morning, CAL FIRE reported the Palisades, Eaton, Kenneth, and Hearst fires had consumed more than 62 square miles, an area larger than San Francisco. The Palisades fire was 11% contained, and containment on the Eaton fire reached 27%. Those two blazes accounted for 59 square miles. Crews from California and 9 other states are part of the ongoing response that includes 1,354 fire engines, 84 aircraft, and more than 14,000 personnel, including newly arrived firefighters from Mexico. Minimal growth was expected Sunday for the Eaton fire, with continued smoldering and creeping of flames. After a fierce battle Saturday, firefighters managed to fight back the flames in Mandeville Canyon, home to Arnold Schwarzenegger and other celebrities near Pacific Palisades, not far from the Pacific coast. where swooping helicopters dumped water as the blaze charged downhill. The fire ran through chaparral-covered hillsides and also briefly threatened to jump over Interstate 405 and into densely populated areas in the Hollywood Hills and San Fernando Valley. Looting continues to be a concern, with authorities reporting more arrests as the devastation grows. Michael Lorenz, a captain with the Los Angeles Police Department, said 7 people have been arrested in the last 2 days. We even made arrests of 2 individuals that were actually posing as firefighters coming in and out of houses. So we're paying very, very close attention to everybody, Lorenz said at Saturday evening's community meeting. Asked exactly how many looters have been arrested, Lorenz said he couldn't give a precise number, but that officers were detaining about 10 people a day. California National Guard troops arrived Friday to help guard properties. California Governor Gavin Newsom posted on X Saturday that California will not allow for looting. The fires that began Tuesday just north of downtown LA have burned more than 12,000 structures. Firefighters for the first time made progress Friday afternoon on the Eaton Fire north of Pasadena, which has burned more than 7,000 structures, a term that includes homes, apartment buildings, businesses, outbuildings, and vehicles. Most evacuation orders for the area were lifted. No cause has been determined for the latest fires, and early estimates indicate the wildfires could be the nation's costliest ever. A preliminary estimate by AccuWeather put the damage and economic losses so far between $135 and $150 billion. In an interview that aired Sunday on NBC, Governor Newsom said the fires could end up being the worst natural disaster in U.S. history. I think it will be in terms of just the costs associated with it, in terms of the scale and scope. Along with crews from other states and Mexico, hundreds of inmates from California's prison system were also helping firefighting efforts. Nearly 950 incarcerated firefighters were dispatched to cut fire lines and remove fuel to slow fire spread, according to an update from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Though the state has long relied on prison labor to fight fires, the practice is controversial as the inmates are paid little for dangerous and difficult work. Inmates are paid up to roughly $10.24 each day, with additional money for 24-hour shifts. Volunteers overflowed donation centers, and some had to be turned away at locations including the Santa Anita Park horse racing track, where people who lost their homes sifted through stacks of donated shirts, blankets, and other household goods. Altadena resident Jose Luis Ganinas said 3 homes occupied by more than a dozen of his family members were destroyed. "Everything is gone," he said, speaking in Spanish. "All my family lived in those 3 houses, and now we have nothing." The level of devastation is jarring, even in a state that regularly confronts massive wildfires. Strom of the State Office of Emergency Services said those impacted by the fires can apply online for immediate government assistance. Newsom issued an extensive order Sunday aimed at fast-tracking the rebuilding of destroyed property by suspending some environmental regulations and ensuring that property tax assessments are not increased. "California leads the nation in environmental stewardship. I'm not going to give that up. But one thing I won't give into is delay. Delay is denial for people, lives, traditions, places torn apart, torn asunder. We've got to let people know that we have their back. Don't walk away because we want you to come back, rebuild, and rebuild with higher quality building standards, more modern standards. We want to make sure that the associated costs with that are not disproportionate, especially in a middle-class community like this." LA Mayor Karen Bass faces a critical test of her leadership during the city's greatest crisis in decades. But allegations of leadership failures, political blame, and investigations have begun. Newsom on Friday ordered state officials to determine why a $117 million gallon, 117 million gallon reservoir was out of service, and some hydrants had run dry. Crowley, the LA fire chief, said city leadership failed her department by not providing enough money for firefighting. She also criticized the lack of water. When a firefighter comes up to a hydrant, we expect there's going to be water, Crowley said. And from the national page, schools plan for possible immigration agent raids. Schools across the country are reviewing what to do if immigration agents come knocking as President-elect Trump prepares to take office after campaigning on a pledge to deport millions of people. In several large cities, school systems are speaking up for the rights of immigrant students to attend school, regardless of whether they are in the country legally, and saying they would not assist immigration and customs enforcement agents. In California this week, officials offered guidance to schools on state law that limits local participation in immigration enforcement. I know there is a lot of fear and anxiety around the incoming administration's anticipated changes to immigration policy, California Attorney General Bonta said, and I want to make sure students, their parents, and their teachers and school administrators are prepared. The 54-page California guide outlines state and federal prosecutions, protections for students and procedures for responding to law enforcement requests, ranging from documents to interviews with students. Many communities debated how much and whether schools should cooperate with immigration authorities during Trump's first administration, when school systems, including Chicago's, took stands against immigration enforcement. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection agents have long abided guidance that deters arresting parents or students at schools and other sensitive locations that provide access to things like medical care and food and shelter. But Trump's re-election and campaign rhetoric on immigration policy sparked discussions over whether those policies will stand. Although the protected area policy remains in effect, it may be modified, superseded, or withdrawn at any time with little notice, the California guidance said. Because of this, and because exceptions to the policy exist, local educational agencies should have plans in place in the event that a law enforcement officer requests information or access to a school site or a student for immigration enforcement purposes. A Trump transition spokesperson did not immediately respond to an emailed request for comment. An estimated 733,000 school-aged children are in the U.S. illegally, according to the Migration Policy Institute. We understand that fear and uncertainty, especially concerning the potential deportation of family members, can significantly impact our students' well-being and their attendance, and their ability to learn, Des Moines Public Schools, where one in four students are English language learners, said in a statement last month in Iowa. The district affirmed a 2017 resolution limiting interactions with the ICE officials to the superintendent. A resolution passed by Chicago Public School Boards of Education in November said schools would not assist ICE in enforcing immigration law. Agents would not be allowed into schools without a criminal warrant. Last month, New York City principals were reminded by the district of policies, including one against collecting information on a student's immigration status. Vermont Principal Chris Young said his district, whose students include children of migrant workers and farm workers, has a long-standing policy of requiring outside law enforcement to produce a warrant if they want access to students. Clearly, students who are worried about their parents being deported or being deported themselves, I think, are high on our list of kids to worry about, said Young, principal of North County Union High School and president-elect of the Vermont Principals Association. And from Tel Aviv, hostages endure another winter. About 100 remain in Gaza as families plead for a ceasefire. When Louis Har was kidnapped by Hamas militants on the warm morning of October 7, 2023, he was forced into Gaza wearing shorts and a t-shirt. As his captivity stretched into weeks and then months, the cold, wet weather set in, bringing along with it a dread he had never endured before. "I felt a penetrating cold in my bones," said Har, 71, who was rescued in mid-February in an Israeli military raid. With no heating in the apartment where he was held, the cold from the floor permeated his thin mattress at night. Fighting outside shattered the apartment windows, sending in rain and wind. While Har is spending his winter warm and free, dozens of hostages still in captivity are not. Their families and supporters are desperate for a ceasefire deal to bring an end to their 15-month nightmare. "Winter makes it much harder, much more complicated," Har said. "They must return as quickly as possible." The hostages often experience the same dire circumstances as hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, whether it be food scarcity, the dangers from Israeli bombardments, or the winter. The war in Gaza, sparked by Hamas's attack, has displaced most of Gaza's 2.3 million population, many of whom are weathering a second winter in tents that are barely holding up against the wind, rain, and temperatures that can drop below 50 degrees Fahrenheit at night. Israel and Hamas are considering a deal that would free some hostages in exchange for Palestinians imprisoned by Israel and a halt to the fighting in Gaza. But despite reports of progress, the families of hostages have been shattered by previous rounds of promising talks that have suddenly collapsed. They fear the same could happen now. "It is a dagger in our hearts," said Ofri Levy about roller coasters of hope and despair the families have lived through the war. Levy's brother Yarden, along with his wife and children, are being held in Gaza. "Either it happens now or it doesn't happen at all." During its attack on southern Israel, Hamas killed 1,200 people and kidnapped about 250, more than 100 of whom were freed in a brief ceasefire in the early weeks of the war. Since then, Israel has killed more than 45,000 people in Gaza, more than half of them women and children, which doesn't distinguish between fighters and non-combatants in its count. Of the roughly 100 hostages who remain in Gaza, one-third are said to be dead, some killed during Hamas's initial attack, and others killed or having died in captivity. Israel has rescued 8 hostages and has recovered the bodies of dozens. The military found the body of another hostage Wednesday in Gaza. The hostages range in age from 1 to 86 and are believed to be scattered throughout the Gaza Strip. They have been held in apartments or in Hamas's web of underground tunnels, which are cramped, damp, and stifling, according to testimony from freed hostages. Many families have no idea what conditions their loved ones face, uncertainty that heightens their concern. Har pled with his captors, who wore heavy coats, to bring them warmer clothes. They did, although they were ridden with holes. Every 10 days or so, they washed themselves with water from a bucket. A shattered window was sealed with a tarp. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, January 13th. Please stay tuned.